pass Rossa's apartment on my way to the orchard. I can hear Julie's and Nora's voices through the window, the living rhythms that once stirred me like music. I still marvel at how effortlessly they converse, how smoothly they transition between speakers with nearly no break in tempo, much less the long, awkward pauses I'm used to. But it no longer enraptures me like it did. I don't stop to listen, I don't close my eyes and sway. My mind is full of hornets. Although I've only been to the orchard once, the route through the plywood labyrinth unfolds for me like I'm a regular, and I find myself standing in front of the pub's thick oak door with little memory of how I got here. The yellow tree painted on it has flaked a little since I saw it last. The aluminum siding still bears two head-sized dents. A satisfied smile starts to creep onto my face, but I halt it. Why did I make those dents? What was I trying to achieve by cracking Balt's head? Was I bringing justice to a man who preys on young girls? Or was it just a brainstem reaction to someone insulting my mate? The kind of primitive reflex that drives the lives of people exactly like Balt. While I stand there staring at the door, it swings open, smacking me between the eyes. I nearly tumble off the mezzanine. "Oh, hey, sorry," says the soldier who opened it, reaching out to steady me. "I didn't see." He recognizes me. He pulls his hand away like I'm a hot stove, straightens up, and leaves without further comment. I lean against the railing, rubbing my forehead. What do I expect to happen for me in a pub? Am I going to strike up a conversation with the fellows at the bar, talk about sports and cars, wave a beer in the air, and lead everyone in rousing anthems of us versus them? No. My ambitions are nothing so grand. I'm just here to make my brain stop working. Grigio's prohibition is over, so the noise levels are now appropriately high, the atmosphere adequately raucous, and the amber nectar in the shot glasses is finally not apple juice. The pub is once again what it was built to be, a place for people to lower their drawbridges, to let others in and themselves out, to remember that life is more than the dimly lit tragedy of the daily grind, a warm, woozy light at the end of the day's tunnel. This will, of course, not be my experience here. I slip through the crowd and find a stool at the far end of the bar, and I can feel a dozen eyes on my back. For a variety of reasons, some good, most bad, I am famous. I am the first of the dead to challenge the plague, the one who triggered a change that's still spreading. I am the disease that cured itself, and I am the monster that kidnapped General Grigio's daughter and brainwashed her into falling in love with it. I am the demon that lured legions of skeletons to the stadium and caused the deaths of hundreds of soldiers, and that may have personally infected General Grigio and thrown his converting corpse off the stadium roof. I am the reason there are zombies roaming their streets and eyeing their children. I am the reason nothing makes sense. I avoid eye contact with everyone but the bartender. When he finally nods to me, I put a bill from the small stack that Rosso gave me to help me find my footing, and I set it on the bar. He looks at me uneasily. What can I get you? Another choice. Another opportunity to tell the world what kind of man I am. What do I wear? What kind of music do I listen to? What is my favorite drink? I shrug and mumble, "Alcohol." He takes the $100 bill, which amounts to little more than a drink ticket in the stadium's sad little private economy, and pours me a shot of whiskey. I dump it down my numb throat and stare at the bar top. The thick pine slab is completely covered in initials, doodles, and crass little dialogues. I peruse them like book spines, trying to imagine the stories behind the titles. K plus N. Fuck Juice. Fuck Grigio. C plus N. Big Dick Tim was here. How long do we do this? E heart N, crossed out. A heart N. N is a slut. Get over it, Evan. JG plus NG, friends for life. Friends crossed out. Lesbos. Big Dick Tim. fucks little girls crossed out, whores. P loves J always. Boozy's back! No Z in our streets. Corpses plus corpse fuckers, GTFO. Where are we going? What are we doing? Look out! There's a bony inside you! It goes on and on, all down the bar. Love, hate, jokes, and the simple urge to be noticed, scrawled onto the wood year after year. The bulk of the inscriptions are on the top of the slab, bumping and overlapping like chatter at a party. But leaning down, I notice a few on the underside, as if never meant to be seen. Most are standard crush confessions. Jerry loves Jenny. Jenny loves Joey. Joey loves Jerry. But one entry catches my eye. It appears to have been carved and then promptly scratched out. I can just barely piece the letters together. A, D, D, I, S. I wince. Cold needles in my chest. I don't know why this word stings. I pull my eyes away from it. They fall immediately on another line, deep in the corner, scratched so faintly I almost miss it in the dim light. Goodbye, Mom. I close my eyes, hoping for salt water to ease their sudden burn. When I open them again, the bartender is looking at me. I slide him another 100. R? My name hits me like a splash of cold water, and I peel my face off the bar. The room spins for a moment before I can anchor it down and bring Julie into focus. What are you doing here? She says. Her eyes are bright blue beacons in the blur of the bar, wide and worried. Drinking? I don't know how many times I've emptied the glass in front of me. It could have been just twice, but my body is still defining its limits, and I do believe I'm drunk. What the hell, R? What happened with the meeting? I still haven't heard from Rosie. Why didn't you come find me? I can see that she's upset. I can see that it's strange, me coming here to drink alone in the middle of a crisis. I can see that she is beautiful, her strawberry lips and blueberry eyes, the peach fuzz on her cheeks. I can see the television behind her, the disorienting montage of unrelated images, a few plays of football, a few airbrushed models, a juicy tenderloin, a cute baby, a syrupy quote from a pop philosopher with a stock footage sunrise behind it. R! The basement door that insists it's not there, the coat of white plaster and all the cracks creeping through it. When is a door not a door? When it's ajar? When it's aflame? When it's asunder? A polite laugh track from a classic sitcom whose cast died decades ago, fat, stupid men with gorgeous wives. Julie sits down next to me. Which trope are we? The gun-toting teenage orphan and her hapless amnesiac boyfriend? Where is the box we can climb into? It's cold out here. She touches my arm. R, are you okay? What happened? I left him with them, I hear myself saying. They're not what they say. They want to eat us, and I left him with them. They want to eat us? What are you talking about? I know them, I mumble. I know them, I know them. No one in the orchard is watching me anymore. At some point after the initial shock of my entrance, they all drifted back to their conversations, or to their blank study of the televisions flashing that nerve-shredding culture collage from every spare nook in the room. A quote over a shot of hand-shaking businessmen read aloud for any illiterates in the room. Don't ask what's in it for you. Ask what you're in it for. A shirtless rock climber, some fluffy clouds, a Corvette. I reach for my glass and try to coax a final drop onto my tongue. Julie snatches it out of my hand and slides it down the bar. R, stop it. I need you to focus. Slow down and tell me what's happening. Should I alert security? They know. Evan Kennerly was there. They made us all leave. They know we can't say no. They know we're scared. My hands tremble on the bar. I pull out my last 100 and shove it at the bartender. Another. Julie grabs the bill and stuffs it in her pocket. I need another. My voice, I've never heard it so loud. It trembles in time with my hands. The TVs are screaming at me. A baseball highlight reel cuts to the middle of an R&B chorus, a wailing, showboating singer doing vocal runs. They're liars. They're going to eat everything we built there. Julie takes my face in her hands and kisses me. My lips don't move, but she puts passion into it, kissing like she's kissing her lover instead of the stiff, open-eyed face of a lunatic. The noise around me softens. The noise inside me softens. The room stops spinning and centers around the lovely face pressed hard against mine, our brains as close to touching as they can ever get. She pulls back and locks her eyes on me, still holding my face. "Focus on my eyes, okay?" she whispers. "Just look at my eyes and take a few breaths." I look at her eyes. They are huge and round, and the bar's lights reflect in their blue centers like distant stars. I take a breath. "Breathing is good," she says. "It's soothing. I know it's new to you, but try to remember. Breathe and think about breathing." My focus narrows until everything behind her is a blur. I think about breathing. My lungs are still sore from years of disuse, but they're slowly warming up and resuming their duties, extracting pure, sweet O2 and sending it to my brain to power living thoughts. Whatever dark fuel my brain once used was better suited to commands and urges than the lovely complexity of a human personality, human hopes and dreams. "I have these," I tell myself, as I float in the muteness of space, holding on to Julie like a tether. "I am allowed these. No one can take them." "Good," she says. "Keep breathing. We're going to be okay. Whatever this is, we can handle it. We don't have anything we can't live without." "Can we leave?" I say during a slow exhalation. "Do we need this city? Where would we go?" "Far away. A cabin in the hills, just us." "Ar," she says, and the tone in that one syllable is enough to reveal the cowardice of my question. "We don't need the city, but we need the people, and they need us." "Why?" "We're trying to build something, remember? You're the one who told me we can't run away." My face sags into her grip. "But I'm tired." "You're not tired," she says with a wry smile. "You're just drunk." She releases my face and I drift. My eyes roam the bar, tracing the faces of the patrons as they stare up at the 5 TVs, their skin tinted gray by the glow of the screens. "R," Julie says, trying to pull me back to earth. "Can you tell me what happened at the meeting?" A late-era rap song boasts about wealth and luxury delivered with a grim wink over a distant, desolate beat that may have been played on trash cans. "Rosie's walkie is off. Should we check on him? It's been 2 hours." A staticky fuzz begins to creep into the audio from the TVs, drowning out the rapper's mournful fantasies. "Where was the meeting? At the community center?" I twist my neck to look at the nearest screen. The audio has been completely replaced by static, and now the image begins to stutter. The rapper opens a briefcase. It's full of money. He sets it on fire and warms his hands. The image goes black. A howl of protest rises from everyone in the room. Someone throws a tumbler at the TV, misses, hits the liquor shelf. Whiskey and glass sprinkles the bar. But the screen remains black for only a few seconds. It flickers, there's a loud pop, and a new image appears. A grainy security camera feed, a fisheye lens gazing down at a man in a white shirt tinkering with a large instrument panel. Another man in a white shirt is faintly visible in the shadows, and Captain Timothy Bolt stands between them, looking uncertain for the first time since I've known him.
"What is this place?" he says, glancing into the shadows around them. "How'd you know this was down here?"
The man at the panel notices something in front of him, and his eyes dart up to the camera, the fisheye lens warping his face into a bulbous horror. He pulls a cable out of a nearby jack, and the image goes black again.
"What the hell's going on?" Julie says.
A harsh squeal erupts from all the TVs, and while everyone covers their ears, something flashes on the screen. It's there for barely a single frame, too brief for me to fully grasp,
but my brain rings like a gong. I see the door again, its rusty metal corners poking out behind crumbling plaster. I hear the drone behind the door, the churning throb of sub-audible bass rumbling up from the basement, rattling the door in its frame, sending chips of plaster flying off like popcorn. My eyes squeeze shut. My mind is dark, and the image blinks in the shadows with maddening brevity, its contours just out of reach, teasing me. I feel my hand moving. R? I grab a martini glass and smash it against the bar. I grip the stem like a dagger. R, what the fuck? I hear the scrape of her stool as she jumps away from me. I'm frightening her. I was so sure I'd never frighten her again. Memories of airports and screams and smears of black blood fill my head as my hand moves. Jagged, concentric shapes. Angles, swallowing angles. A grotesque mandala with nothing in its center. I open my eyes. I've carved a design, a logo, into the surface of the bar. Its deep lines cut through lover's initials. The door rattles. At Vist, my mouth says. The door cracks open. A tall building. A dim room. An old man. A grin. A briefcase. A plan. I hesitate. I accept. I board a plane. I watch a screen. A nature show. A worm and a wasp. I watch. I recoil. I keep watching. The worm burrows into the wasp. The worm seizes its brain, tells it where to fly, feeds on its guts, builds a home out of its corpse. The worm is small, clever, twisted, mad. The worm wins. The worm knows no beauty, no pleasure, no purpose. The worm knows nothing but what it does. The worm wins, and the worm feasts. Wasps, wolves, poets, presidents. The worm feasts.
Trust me, kid.
Brown teeth, spotted gums, a bony hand on my shoulder.
I know my business.
R! The sting of a slap. Frightened blue eyes searching for mine in the darkness. I slam the basement door shut and pull the orchard back into view. And in all the shadowy fragments spinning through my mind, I see one clear imperative. I shake Julie off me, and I run.
R, stop!
I shove the heavy door open, knocking over two soldiers who topple back into the deck railing. Julie is in the doorway, calling to me, but I can't stop. I run, stumbling, gripping the cables to keep from falling off the catwalk, slipping down the staircase and caroming off the walls, finally bursting out into the street. I feel my badly lubricated joints creaking, my stiff ligaments protesting as I push them into a sprint. The surprising weight of the briefcase, the cold metal in my hands, the decision I insisted I hadn't made. I see the armory door at the end of the street. Towers of metal and plywood loom over me like judges, but I'm so close. I can fix my mistake before anyone notices. I can... A flash. A hammer of air. I'm flying. The moon glares down at me as I sail backward, arms spinning. A lazy summertime float down the river. Is this your preferred position? The moon asks me. On your back and half asleep, drifting away from the fight. I hit the wall of an apartment and crash through the sheet metal into a child's bedroom. A girl jumps up in her bed and I see her face contort into a squeal of terror, but it's silent. I hear only the high ringing of a tuning fork. I free myself from the debris. I stumble back onto the street and into a silent nightmare. Chunks of concrete rain from the sky, silently cratering the asphalt and punching holes through walls and roofs. Silent rockets streak out from a cloud of smoke and pinwheel madly through the stadium, blooming into silent fireballs that incinerate buildings and tear chunks out of the stadium wall. Support cables pop out of the concrete and rickety apartment towers sway. Silently, two of them fall, crashing into each other and splitting open in the middle, dumping streams of people out of their beds and onto the street. Those who survive the fall have just enough time to raise their hands in a futile defensive gesture before being buried under their own homes. The darkness pulses red with countless fires. Crates of grenades go off in bursts of white flashes. I run past dead bodies that are beginning to twitch, but I leave it to someone else to decide their second fates. I can't stop. I'm running toward a smoking hole where I abandon someone who believes in me, and as my hearing returns, I notice that I am screaming. The raw edges of shattered concrete are still hot enough to burn my hands as I dig my way through the debris, but I feel the sensation more distantly than ever.
I hear salvos of gunfire from somewhere in the wreckage, but this is not a battle. It's just ammunition going off, bullets firing themselves without waiting for the trigger, as if they know what they were made to do and are eager to get on with it.
I heave aside a slab of concrete and slip through the gap into what's left of the armory. It's dark, but cut electrical wires light the cavern in blue flashes, along with the dim red glow of burning supply crates.
Rosso!
I shout into the flickering darkness.
General Rosso!
The path is littered with jagged concrete and spears of sheared rebar, but I start to run. I don't get more than a few paces before I trip on something soft. An electric pop from an overhead wire illuminates a body with most of its flesh blasted away, revealing a scorched, cracked skeleton, identifiable only by the shredded tie around its neck. Black tie says nothing. I push further in, past the garage and into Grigio's beloved war room. In the sickly orange glow of a few burning tires, I find the other two pitchmen. Blue Tie grins up at me from the floor, his impossibly blue eyes attempting to establish trust with the ceiling, while his mangled body slumps in a corner 10 feet away. A steel beam runs through Yellow Tie's skull from temple to temple, pinning her head to the floor, and I search her final expression for any hint of comprehension, any realization of error or betrayal, but it remains locked in that blandly cheerful mask. What are these people? A ragged gasp from somewhere in the shadows. I force myself to move. He's lying slumped against a pile of rubble. His chest isn't shaped right, and his gray jumpsuit has turned dark purple. Perhaps he has spilled wine on himself, overindulged at a tasting party, embraced life a little too hard. He'll have a headache in the morning, but good stories to go with it. Julie and I will sit by his fireplace and listen, glancing at each other and smiling while Ella shakes her head in the kitchen. He is old, but still vital, with plenty of days left to read his books and drink his wine and teach me how to be a person.
I'm sorry,
he whispers as I kneel beside him.
For what?
Why is there a tremor in my voice? He's just drunk.
I wanted so badly to see your life. You and Julie.
He coughs, and a fine spray of wine speckles my shirt.
I wanted to be there.
Why do my eyes sting? Why is my vision getting blurry?
But I'm excited, too.
He stares up at the patches of night sky visible through holes in the ceiling.
I've wondered for so long what comes next.
Drunk people say the strangest things. I squint my eyes shut and warm liquid seeps out of them.
Oh,
he says, and his tone suddenly shifts. I open my eyes and find his wide with awe, his mouth slightly agape.
I can see it.
Stop, I grip his shoulders. Wait. His eyes focus on me with a feverish intensity.
We're so close, Ar. Show them.
I don't know what you're saying. His eyes drift to the ceiling again. His body begins to slacken.
It's beautiful,
he says in a faint release of breath.
It's everything.
I watch his face for a while. I burn the image into my memory. I have never seen an expression like this. It says things that no one could ever articulate, no matter how vast their vocabulary or how limber their tongue. And in a moment, it will be gone. I dig through the rubble. A grenade. A chainsaw. No. Something elegant, respectful, if there is any respectful way to do this. The most important thing is that I do it soon. There can be no third life for this man's broken body, and I won't let him suffer the indignity of becoming like me. I hear a gunshot. I assume it's another burning ammo crate and ignore it, but then I hear a small, frail sob, and I turn. Ella is kneeling in front of her husband, her hair singed and wild, the knees of her pants torn and bloody. A revolver dangles from her fingers and falls to the floor. Some soft, whispering instinct tells me to move toward her. As soon as I'm near enough, she sags against my chest and lets the dam break. I hear Julie's voice as we approach the tunnel's exit. She's calling the names of all the people who matter to her. Nora's, Ella's, Rosso's, mine. I wonder if any of us will be of any comfort to her. I help Ella over the last jagged heap of debris, and we stumble out into the chaos of the streets. Security teams rush from house to house, trying to establish some kind of order, but medical is the star of tonight's show. I catch a glimpse of Nora holding one end of a stretcher bearing a blood-smeared mess that looks like Kennerly. I catch her eyes for 1 second before she disappears around a corner, and the reeling shock in them tells me just how bad things are. But right now, the pain of hundreds of strangers barely even registers. I'm focused on the old woman crying on my arm, and the young one running toward me with eyes full of dread. "What happened?" Julie shouts. "What the hell happened? What is happening?" She grabs my wrists and sucks in a breath to ask more unanswerable questions. I wrap my arms around her and pull her close. Through the crook of my elbow, she sees Ella sinking down onto an apartment stoop. She sees the tears running through the woman's laugh lines. She sees the smoking crater in the stadium wall. She understands. "No," she says. "No." "I'm sorry," I whisper into her hair. "No," she screams and wriggles violently out of my arms. "This is not happening. It's not happening, no." She stands back from me and Ella, alone in the middle of the street, clenching her fists and grinding her teeth. She lost her mother long before I met her. Her father slowly left over many years, but the dirt on his grave has barely sprouted grass. And now this. Now Lawrence, Rosie, Rosso, her next-to-last fragment of family. Grief. Rage. Both are reasonable responses to the winking cruelty of the universe. I move toward her and try to embrace her again, but she is nowhere near ready to be consoled. She shoves me back so hard I almost fall over and runs past me toward the armory. "Julie, don't," Ella calls to her. "There's nothing in there that will help." Julie stops at the edge of the rubble, staring into the dark hole and trembling, sucking in short, rapid breaths. These constrict into raspy wheezes, and she fumbles in her pocket for her inhaler. She takes a shot, but her breaths keep getting shorter. She clutches at her throat. "I can't, I can't." I rush to her side and try to lead her away from the wreckage, but she sags down onto the pavement, heaving hard against her bronchial tubes. I want to say something soothing, but what can I possibly say? My mouth is not accustomed to delivering comfort. The apparatus of my tongue and teeth has always been a weapon. How does one use it to heal? In the silence of my uselessness, the medicine finally kicks in and her gasps begin to slow. She struggles to her feet and walks on rubbery legs to the stoop where Ella is sitting. She pulls in a deep breath, lets it out, then drops down next to Ella and buries her face in her hands, her small body shaking with quiet sobs. I stay where I am, standing apart from them, waiting. I feel a cold sprinkle of rain and I look up. The sky is clear, the moon is bright. With the noise of 20,000 people panicking, I didn't even notice the helicopters overhead, spraying water onto the flames that surge from apartment rooftops. I see it now. The pieces click. We're here to help. High above, hovering like a book of divine wisdom, the jumbotron blinks on. A handsome man in a yellow tie steps into view and sits in front of a microphone. "Residents of City Stadium," he says in a gentle baritone. We invite you to feel calm. Careless storage of expired munitions has led to a terrible tragedy and loss of life from both enclaves, but as your new next-door neighbor, the Axiom Group is already working hard to minimize the damage. I notice men in unfamiliar uniforms, beige jackets over khaki pants, rushing through the streets with fire extinguishers and first aid kits. We will have the disaster contained momentarily, and in the days to come, we will work closely with your remaining leadership to help restore order. We invite you to feel calm, safe, and secure. Everything will be the way it was. Julie peeks through her fingers at the gigantic face grinning down on the city.
The screen shows a brief flash of the logo I carved into the bar, plays a stock animation of a football player chugging a Bud Light, then goes black.
What is happening? She whispers into her palms. The rumble of an approaching truck cuts through the noise of the stadium's panic, which has in fact quieted noticeably following the Jumbotron's announcement. It seems that an invitation to feel calm from a stranger on a screen is all these people need to feel calm. Do they even care who's in charge of their lives? Or will any handsome face suffice? Any well-groomed head with a tie around its stump? Any mouth that can lie with confidence? Staring up at the helicopters, feeling the spray cool my flushed cheeks, I realize I'm still drunk. Or perhaps something even more debilitating. I have imbibed a terrible cocktail. Whiskey, adrenaline, shock, and sorrow. I feel sick. A beige Escalade pulls up next to us, and six men in beige jackets emerge. It's a nauseating color, not a warm, sandy tan, but the neutral green-gray taupe of old office computers, cheap hotels, suburban strip malls, and municipal carpet. The men carry three empty body bags between them. They move toward the armory entrance, and suddenly Julie is on her feet. "What are you doing?" she snaps, wiping her red eyes and darting over to block their path. "Who are you and what are you doing?"
"Here to collect the bodies,"
one of the men says without looking at her or stopping. He and the others move around her and begin to climb through the rubble, but she jumps in front of them again. "I said, who are you?" The men slow their advance without quite stopping.
"We're with Axiom. We're here to collect the bodies."
"That's my friend in there and I don't know you people," she says, glaring up at the much taller men. Her voice begins to tremble again.
"You're not taking him. Go away." "We have orders to collect all the bodies before they're handled by Enclave residents. Please step aside."
He pushes past her. She grabs his jacket and yanks him backward and he falls, landing on jagged chunks of concrete.
"I said go away,"
she shouts hoarsely, her eyes welling up again. In my woozy perception, everything feels slow. I move toward Julie, but my feet are strapped with heavy weights. One of the men shoves her. She falls into the rubble. She gets up, wipes blood from a cut on her forehead, and lunges at him. Too short to reach his face, she punches him in the throat. He stumbles back, choking, and I hear Julie screaming.
"Get out of here! Get out!"
I'm almost there. The ground sucks at my feet like deep tar. I crawl up the rubble heap as four men converge on her. She takes a swing at the nearest one, but he grabs her arm and twists her around, then kicks her hard between the shoulder blades. She flies clear of the mound and lands face down on the asphalt. I am full of dread because I know I'm going to kill this man. It's required by Newtonian law, a reaction to his action, impossible to prevent. I ascend the rubble heap and seize his head and smash his face into a concrete corner and he dies in a bubbling foam of blood. The next man who comes at me doesn't die, but is certainly maimed when I throw him against a slab and hammer my fist into his shoulder joint, snapping the ligaments and effectively severing his arm. Thick limbs wrap around my throat and lift me off the ground, but my brain seems to have a course of action ready for every scenario. A well-aimed elbow breaks the man's ribs and hopefully punctures his lung, and his grip melts off me. A very distant voice asks, "What am I doing? How am I doing it? Who is the man who acquired these skills and the reptilian coldness to use them?" Finally, someone relieves me of my momentum. The butt of a gun cracks into the side of my head, and the already slow world spins into a rippling sludge. I am aware of myself falling, but I feel nothing when my face hits the pavement next to Julie's. Our eyes meet. Hers red and wet. Mine simply open, staring. Where is the gold? Where is the impossible solar yellow that told us things were different? That we had changed and the world would change with us? Dark spots begin to splatter across my vision. I try to speak to her. Keep breathing. We're going to be okay. But my lips won't obey. I try to say it with my eyes. I keep trying until my eyes roll up.
We do not need to move. We are already everywhere. But omnipresence can be dull, so we indulge in locality. We condense ourselves into points and roam the earth like those quaint old notions of spirits, ghosts, angels, and other things in white sheets. We have little interest in the world itself, the actual matter and space. We are here for the story, for the landscape of consciousness overlying the dust and rock. In that landscape, sharp peaks are jutting up from the plains. There are quakes and floods and hurricanes, and rivers of magma press against the surface. That landscape is changing, and change demands our attention. So we move. We drift through the upheaval of a city in crisis, remembering the scent of smoke, the pain of fire, the sorrow of loss. Everywhere, men in beige jackets are herding people back into their homes, assuring them that they have it all under control and everything will return to normalcy, that cozy dream that's buried 1,000 revolutions. In their panic, most of the people do as they're told. They see confident men issuing clear instructions, and they don't much care who those men are or what the instructions entail. They just want to keep their families safe. They just want to survive the night. There will be time for questions later, on some distant morning when the fires are out and they're no longer scared or hurt or hungry. But the men in beige jackets are encountering one unexpected variable, a single ripple in this calm sea of compliance. There are certain individuals scattered throughout the crowds who do not react predictably. Their minds lack the key for the codes being shouted at them, so they do not respond to instructions or assurances, no matter how confidently delivered. They stand motionless in the streets, watching the men in beige jackets roar commands that blend into the promises pouring from the stadium PA, and they do not respond. The men in beige jackets move closer in order to become more forceful, and that's when they notice that something is different about these individuals. The tint of their skin, the slowness of their movements, the scar tissue in the shape of bullet holes, knife slashes, and wide patches of regenerated rot, but mostly their eyes, many different hues, alike in defiance. We drift toward a building that radiates pain, but as we get closer, we notice other accumulations, plague and its opposite, golden flickers of cure. Something like a smile spreads through our vastness. "You'll be okay," Nora Green tells a man with 3 shards of concrete sticking out of his back. "They're not deep. I'll be back in a second to patch you up." "Wait," he gasps as she moves away. "Don't leave me." "God, you're needy. This is why we never would have worked." "Nora, you're gonna be fine, Evan. Just stay calm. I'll be right back." She darts away from his bed to attend to another patient. The warehouse once seemed awkwardly large for this miniature ER, but now every inch of empty space has been filled with the wounded. Their accommodations follow a steady grade of increasing desperation, from proper electric hospital beds to stained twin mattresses to wool blankets thrown on the concrete floor. We jump from nurse to nurse. There are few proper doctors in this age of austerity. And then return to Nora, following her as she bandages the living and comforts the dying. A group of civilians stands in a corner, waiting for the signal that it's time to say their goodbyes and then shoot their loved ones in the head. but sometimes they can't do it, and the task falls to Nora. A Colt 45 sticks out of the waistband of her scrubs, an instrument as essential to modern medicine as a scalpel. In all the blood and screaming, no one is paying attention to the rows of special patients whose beds line the walls. Many of these have far more serious injuries, missing limbs, gaping holes, but their wounds don't bleed. These patients sit up in their beds and observe the chaos with wide eyes. The living do everything so vibrantly, the dead think. Their blood sprays like party champagne. They hoot and howl like a gospel choir. Even in their agony, they are enviable. While the dead watch the living die, a group of men in white shirts files in through a side door and surrounds them. One of these men unfolds a pocket knife. He sticks it into a patient's arm. The patient doesn't flinch, but she looks up at the man with an expression of offense. Hurt feelings. "What are you?" the man demands.
"A person," the patient replies.
"No, you're not," the man says, and moves the knife down the patient's arm, opening a gash. The patient's face darkens.
"Stop."
"Hey!"
Nora shouts from across the room. She hands off her patient to another nurse and rushes toward this forgotten corner of the hospital.
"What the fuck are you doing? Who are you?"
"We're with the Axiom Group. What are these people?"
"What do you mean, what are they?
Are they living or dead?"
"They're trying to decide. Why the fuck are you sticking knives in my patients?"
"We have orders to investigate these uncategorized individuals."
"They're zombies. They're trying not to be. What else do you need to know?"
"The dead don't try. They're passive tissue waiting for input." Nora rolls her eyes.
"Jesus Christ, Grigio all over again. Listen, I don't have time for this. I have people to sew up."
He points his knife at the patient's face. "They're ignoring our instructions and interfering with aid efforts." The patient slaps the knife out of his hand. The man looks shocked.
"See? Get out of my morgue," Nora says.
"We'll need to take some of them back to Goldman Dome for study. 3 should be enough for now." Nora takes a step toward the man.
"I said get out."
We notice things about Nora Green that interest us. Many small scars darken the skin of her arms and face, and her left hand is missing a finger. Chapters of her life written bold on her flesh, calling us to read them. The man in the white shirt notices these things too, and they concern him, but not as much as the pistol in Nora's right hand, which she is tapping emphatically against her thigh. The man pulls out his walkie. "Management? Request assistance in the medical building." He looks from Nora's blood-smeared scrubs to her bloodshot eyes. "We're encountering resistance." I don't sleep well. I'm not good at it. Sleep is a ceasefire with life, and I don't trust my opponent. I lie awake all night expecting ambush. In my dead days, sleep meant lying on the floor and staring at the ceiling, trying to regather my decomposing consciousness. I would go months without it, and when it came, it was always a terrible collapse. No peaceful descent into a feather bed with a book and a cup of chamomile, more like a surprise bullet to the kneecap, dropping me to the floor in a confused and frightened pile. Since the first night I closed my eyes and truly dreamed, lying next to Julie on a stranger's mildewed mattress, my relationship with sleep has improved, but it's still dysfunctional. Most nights find me listening to her soft snores deep into the morning, passing the time by trying to decode her twitches and whimpers and half-formed words, imagining what colorful horrors her brain has prepared for her, and wondering how to comfort her when she wakes up. If I'm lucky, I'll drift into a shallow slumber for an hour or two, but my mind, traumatized by years of death, remains wary of anything that resembles it. So, in a way, getting knocked unconscious by the butt of a gun is rather refreshing. I haven't slept this well in ages. Deep in the dark alley of my mind, a grizzled street prophet is muttering news of fire and judgment, but I ignore him and stride past with my chin held high. I feel light. I am on a tropical island, swimming in warm blue water while gulls soar above and dolphins glide below. My abs are cut gems and my skin is a healthy bronze. Julie is on the beach in a bikini and sunglasses, oiling her flawless body, her huge breasts, her endless legs. We are on vacation. We are in love. We are in a nightclub, and the music is pounding, and I am dancing with Julie. I dance well. My hips and limbs swing in perfect rhythm, pantomiming sex in front of 100 strangers without a hint of shame. My pockets are full of money and drugs, and Julie is grinding into me with abandon, her long hair whipping into my face, her red skirt hiking higher and higher, and everyone is watching us with envy and lust. I smirk at them and take Julie home to our high-rise condo, and we fuck all night without pause or reservation, not looking at each other, but at the city below our windows, spreading itself before us like a submissive whore offering us everything. I am on a private plane, ensconced in soft leather and bathed in tropical jazz, looking down on endless miles of ruined cities and all the poor fools still inhabiting them. Julie sits next to me, and the sight of her brings a stern frown to my face, because I am dressed for serious business, silver shirt and red tie, but she's not wearing a pantsuit or pencil skirt or even a shoulder-padded blazer. She's wearing jeans and a plaid flannel, a red stocking cap pulled over her tangled hair. I'm about to scold her when I notice my own outfit is also a little off. The fabric of my shirt has a thick, tough texture, and instead of classic Italian wingtips, heavy black boots caked with mud. I look up at Julie. Her face is tight with sadness and fear, pleading with me. The edge of her cap is wet. A trickle of blood runs down her forehead and pools in her eye. I glance to my right and see two men and a woman wearing the same outfits I'm wearing. One of the men has a silver briefcase. He winks at me. I feel myself lifting out of my seat as the plane dives, hurtling down into an endless expanse of dark green trees. The music gets louder as we fall, the marimbist striking the tines in a rage, breaking the mallets.
"Please don't leave me," Julie whispers into my ear. "Please don't go back."
My eyes open halfway, but I'm not confident that I'm awake. The music is still there, down to a reasonable volume now. The tropical jazz fades into an upbeat country number, still watery and nondescript, but with a faint twang to indicate we have shifted cultures. I'm in some kind of dark chamber, and the music is emanating from a speaker in the ceiling, but it's hard to make out details through the profusion of colorful spots in my vision, like a 4th of July fireworks show between me and the outside world. My head pounds. I hear the squeak of hinges, and a blurry silhouette hovers in the doorway. The face comes into focus for just a moment before my eyes slacken again, but it's enough to pour a sludge of fear into my delirium, because I recognize the face, and it belongs to someone who is dead. Perhaps I'm dead, too. Perhaps I died years ago, and hell is a flooded planet of starving children and walking corpses and endless, senseless war. I summon air into my lungs and croak, "Perry?" I catch a glimpse of startled eyes. Then the fireworks show resumes, the pedal steel swells. I'm on a ranch. I'm holding the rope while Julie trots the new colt around the arena. I've never seen her happier. Her face is... Someone is shaking my shoulders. I scowl and dig in deeper. Julie leans against the colt's shimmering chestnut neck and rests her cheek on his mane as I lead him back to the barn.
"Wake up!"
a man shouts into my ear. I squirm and try to shut him out, whoever he is, this horrible alarm dragging me into this horrible morning. "Snooze. Snooze. Please snooze." We stroll hand in hand toward the farmhouse, and it's warm and full of history. It has been in my family for generations, handed down to me by my father, who was kind and courageous, who instilled nothing but hope in his son and never once told him that only God could love his filthy human heart. The music stops. My eyes snap open. A man and a woman are watching me from across a small table. Another man is standing next to me, pressing a live wire into my ribs, which explains why my back is arching and my wrists are straining and why I'm tied to a chair with a length of coaxial cable. The man removes the wire and I go slack. "You're quite the deep sleeper," the woman in the yellow tie says, like a mother chiding her teenage son. "We apologize for any discomfort," the man in the blue tie adds. The man in the black tie returns to his seat. I really am dead. I'm surrounded by faces that I've seen bloodied and charred on the ground. What unjust afterlife is this that I have to share it with these obscene creatures? "We're glad you're awake," Yellow Tie says, reaching toward me and placing her palm on the table, a gesture evoking intimacy and trust. "We have a very exciting offer to share with you." Of course, it's not really Yellow Tie. Not the one I saw with a pole through her head, anyway. Longer nose, thinner lips. But the differences in her features vanish into the sameness of everything else. Her clothing, her posture, her empty cardboard earnestness. Blue Tie's hair is lighter, his chin sharper, and Black Tie is less bulky. But they are the same three people, as if their bodies are originals, but their souls are copies. My eyes dart around the room. All the lights are broken except one fluorescent tube buzzing overhead, bathing the pitchmen in a pale, unforgiving light that highlights the seams between their makeup and their flesh.
"And what are you kids supposed to be? We're human beings! Trick or treat!"
The room is dark, but I can see that I'm alone with these creatures. "Where's Julie?" I ask Yellow Tie. I don't sense any particular authority structure, but it seems to be her role to tell people things they want to hear, and I want to hear that Julie is safe, even if it comes from the world's least trustworthy mouth. The mouth smiles blandly. I try to stand up and realize my ankles are tied to the legs of the chair. "We apologize for any discomfort," Blue Tie says again. "Unfortunately, due to recent difficulties, we do need to keep you restrained at this time to ensure the safety of Axiom employees."
"Where is Julie?"
I shout at him. But the cold plastic smiles they're all wearing tell me I won't get far talking to them like people. I'm not having a conversation. I'm watching a commercial. "No doubt you're aware of the terrible tragedy that took place in the stadium," Blue Tie says, switching to his grave and reverential face. "Improper storage of expired munitions led to an explosion that took nearly 100 lives, including those of the Enclave's central leadership."
"Fortunately," Yellow Tie chimes in like they're singing a duet, "the Axiom Group was right next door, ready to assist our new West Coast neighbors. Working closely with City Stadium's existing security and medical teams, we have been able to contain the damage and provide aid to the victims."
"You did this," I mumble, looking at the table. "Everyone will know you did this. They'll fight you." The peculiar sensation of reliving a moment from a dream, a memory of a conversation that never happened.
"Trust me, kid. I know my business."
"We have offered some of our best people to fill the holes in the city's management," Yellow Tie says, "and its remaining members have been very receptive to our help."
I begin to shake my head, my arms flexing against the cables. "Where we are encountering some difficulty," Blue Tie says, "is with the non-living population of the stadium and surrounding area." I stop shaking my head and look up.
"Since arriving on the West Coast," Yellow Tie says, "we have encountered a puzzling..."
"A puzzling?" She blinks.
"Thing. A puzzling thing."
Her smile falters for the first time and her expression crinkles into something like discomfort. Blue Tie steps in to rescue her. "We have encountered non-living persons who are non-standard, who do not, who show puzzling signs of..." He grimaces and lowers his head. "Life?" I offer.
"We have encountered unknowns," Yellow Tie blurts.
Blue Tie's head rises again. "We have encountered unknowns. They behave differently.
We have been unable to predict their responses, and this poses a danger.
The Axiom Group wants to help, Yellow Tie says. We want to provide security to this region and to the entire world.
But security is impossible where unknowns exist, Blue Tie says. Security is impossible when hundreds of thousands of unknowns exist. Silence. Yellow Tie and Blue Tie both watch me with pained expressions. Absurdly, I find myself glancing at Black Tie for guidance, but he continues to be little more than statuary.
What do you want with me? I finally snap, and it's like pushing a skipping record needle back onto its groove. Their smiles blink on again.
You're like them, Yellow Tie says, and slides her palm across the table again, not quite touching me.
But you're different. You influence them.
No, I don't. It's widely known that you instigated this deviation, Blue Tie says. You caused these unknowns to appear.
I didn't do anything. It just happened.
Yellow Tie leans toward me, fixing me with a look of intimacy that suggests it's time to brush aside the posturing and be real with each other.
We need your help, she says softly. We want everyone to be secure in their places. We want to eliminate confusion, but we're finding it difficult to communicate the benefits to these non-standard individuals. They are unnaturally resistant to our help.
Her face is about 2 feet from mine, eyes big and imploring. I notice that her makeup goes all the way down her neck, and I wonder if it covers her whole body, bronzing her veiny breasts and smoothing her withered holes. A scent like overripe pineapple wafts up from beneath her collar. Corpses know what death smells like, I say, staring her in the face. Your cheap perfume can't hide it. Her expression holds for a moment. Then it flashes into a smile. Black Tie steps around the table and shoves the wire into my neck.
Unfortunately, Blue Tie says as I convulse, if you are unable to recognize either the rewards of working with us or the risks of refusing, coercion does become necessary at this time. If at any time during this interview you would like to accept our offer, Yellow Tie says, simply say yes.
Electric shock is a strange pain. At this voltage, very little physical damage is occurring, but my nerves still throw a tantrum. My muscles clench into knots, fire erupts in my joints, my bones tell my brain they're being shattered, and my brain itself complains of hot coals and daggers. But when Black Tie removes the wire, there's no harm done. No blood, no foul, as they say in sports.
Fascinating.
The pitchmen watch me and wait. I sit in my chair, looking idly around the room. They frown, and Black Tie pokes the wire into my throat. My neck tendons bulge. Bolts of pain flash up and down my spine, and I swear I can feel my brain heating up like meat in a microwave. But I watch all this suffering from my hotel balcony, taking footage from afar with an expensive zoom lens. The pain is real. I'm aware that I'm in agony, but I just don't care. Black Tie removes the wire, and Blue and Yellow watch me expectantly. I shrug. This display of endurance is unnecessary, Blue Tie says through his glued-on grin. You cannot outlast your interview. It will continue until we reach one of two possible outcomes.
One outcome is you assisting us, Yellow Tie says.
The other is you dying. I shrug again. Been dead before. It's not so bad. Their smiles falter. I enjoy about 3 seconds of triumph. Then the pitchmen cock their heads, listening. I hear a commotion through the wall behind me, a clatter of furniture, a muffled shout. The pitchmen regard me like cheery mannequins, wordless and motionless, as if waiting for something. Through the wall comes a high shriek of pain mixed with indignant fury.
Fuck you! Fuck you, you dressed-up sacks of shit! You Botoxed baby fuckers!
Julie. I lurch against my bonds, trying to turn the chair around.
Julie! I'm here!
Another scream, less rage this time, more pain. No words.
What art doing to her?
I growl at the pitchman, all my hard-won fluency melting away in the heat of panic. We are making her a comparable offer, Yellow Tie says.
Does she share your ambivalence toward discomfort? Blue Tie asks me.
Julie's scream rises higher and higher and then breaks off, collapses into a sob. My eyes squeeze shut. I see fireworks. I see fire. I see flames roaring from rooftops, kids running from schools. I see rapturous faces watching the flames, watching me, hands clapping, applauding, eyes glittering in the orange light, and a bottle in my hand, a flaming rag stuffed into it. I see a cheap plywood casket descending into a hole in the ground, a preacher sprinkling platitudes into it like piss into a toilet, while fools watch and pretend to weep. I see a blonde woman in a forest, bruised and bloody, eyes full of loathing as she presses my gun to her forehead. I open my eyes. Julie is tied to a chair by my side, our shoulders almost touching. She is looking at me with a kind of bleakly apologetic smile, breathing hard, her eyes red and wet. "Hi, R," she says. Her face is spotted with small bruises. Her lower lip is cracked and puffy. On the side of her neck, just above the clavicle, precisely my favorite place to kiss, the skin is mottled with the bluish brown of an electrical burn. I feel the TV cables cutting into my ankles and forearms. I hear the chair creaking under the strain. "Stop," she says gently. "I'm okay. Don't give them what they want." "Unfortunately," Blue Tie says, "we do need to continue the interview at this time. Remember," Yellow Tie says, "if at any time you would like to accept our offer, simply say yes." Black Tie sticks the wire into the burn on Julie's neck. "Stop it," I scream as she writhes against her bonds. "Stop." "If you would like to accept our offer, simply say, we can't do what you want," I sputter, choking on my tongue. "Even if wanted to, can't. We don't control the dead." "Our reports show that you are viewed as leadership figures by the non-living population," Yellow Tie says. "We look forward to working with you toward a greater mutual understanding."
"Yes,"
Julie growls through clenched teeth as she writhes in her chair.
"Yes."
Black Tie removes the wire from Julie's neck and she slumps over, gasping. "You agree to assist us?" Yellow Tie asks, her smile radiating goodwill.
"Yes,"
Julie wheezes. I stare at her, unsure what to feel. "You are aware, of course," Blue Tie says, "that these interviews will remain available to you throughout our partnership. If at any point your cooperation wanes, they will resume." "We believe in ongoing commitment to excellence," Yellow Tie says. "Yes" should be more than just a word. "Oh," Julie says, straightening up in her chair. "Well, in that case, no." Yellow Tie tilts her head and pouts like a disappointed mother. "We apologize for our failure to communicate effectively," Blue Tie says. Black Tie sets the power cord down and opens a case full of electrician's tools. "Julie," I plead with her, though I don't know what I'm pleading for. Do I want to give in? Do I want to do my best to help them own the dead along with the living? How much of the world would I burn to keep Julie safe?
"It's okay," she says. "We'll be okay."
Black Tie pulls out a pair of cable shears. He sets them on Julie's lap and pries open her fist, forcing her fingers flat against the chair's arm.
"No," I say. "No, no, Julie, I can't."
"R, listen to me," she says, her voice beginning to tremble. "I'm not going to help them. That's my choice. So no matter what they do to me." Her eyes dart toward her hand as Black Tie spreads her fingers out and picks up the shears. They dart back to me, wide with panic. "No matter what they do to me," she shrieks. The tip of her ring finger falls to the floor. One unique print, one yellow-painted nail, rolling across the filthy floor and vanishing beneath a locker. My mind becomes a furnace of incoherent horror.
"Stop!" I scream at Yellow Tie. "I'll do it! What do you want me to do? I'll do it!"
"R," Julie snaps savagely.
"You don't get to surrender for me.
It's my choice, and I've fucking made it.
Black Tie moves the shears further up, toward the base of the finger.
You don't always have to keep me safe, she says,
her voice suddenly soft, and she somehow manages a smile.
That's not why I love you.
A tiny sound, like the snap of a fresh carrot. Blood on Black Tie's shirt, an artful splatter that looks just like one of Julie's paintings. She's embarrassed by all her work, but she singles that one out for scorn. A silly attempt to be Jackson Pollock, she calls it. I don't care that it's derivative. I appreciate the form, the bright colors, the passion, and the wild swings of her brush. I break the front legs off my chair and lunge into Black Tie and knock him to the floor and headbutt him over and over. His nose breaks. His eye socket breaks. I'm going to do this until everything breaks, until both our heads merge into one mess of bone fragments and pulp. He stabs the power cord into the base of my skull, and this time, I feel it. True pain. Up close and intimate. Bursting out from the core of my brain and crackling through my eyes and teeth. I've tumbled off my balcony and into the muddy streets, and the locals are swarming over me with clubs and knives and fists, hissing, "Welcome, foreigner. Is it everything you hoped?" I see Julie high above me as I writhe on the floor. Warm drops of her blood fall on my face like tropical rain, and behind her agony, I see sadness. I see grief. I see our tender little dream receding into blackness. Faces drift past me as I float through my delirium. I see the pitchmen, their grins gone, their expressions slack, communicating with each other through small gestures and occasional grunted vocalizations. I see Julie being carried away by a man in a beige jacket. I call out from somewhere in the darkness and grasp around frantically, trying to find my body in all these suffocating shadows. I succeed in jerking my limbs and emitting a faint groan, and the man in the beige jacket turns around. At the end of my blurry tunnel of vision, I see the face of an old friend. Perry's eyes are troubled, and he shakes his head as if to say, "Don't panic, it'll be okay." And for some reason, I believe him. I stop thrashing. I watch the ghost of the man I killed carry away the body of the woman we both love, and I sink back into the shadows.
"Can you hear me? Look up."
A soft, smoky voice, imperfect in pitch, but rich in timbre.
"The clouds are lifting, the windows open. Time to grow a pair of wings."
The tune is familiar, the words doubly so. Lines from a film merged with the melody from a memory. A girl in a field, a man reaching out to her from miles away.
"Look up, look up."
I open my eyes and look up. Julie smiles down at me. My head is resting on her lap, and she is stroking my hair with her right hand. Her left hand lies limp on her knee, wrapped in bloody gauze.
"Lazy boy," she murmurs. "You've been getting a lot of sleep lately. Feel refreshed?"
I drag myself upright and then collapse against her shoulder as my head pops like a water balloon, gushing agony into every corner of my body. My brain, that lump of boiled hamburger that I've protected for so long, the only part I ever considered worth the effort. How can it possibly be functioning through pain like this?
"I guess that's a no," Julie says.
She runs her fingers through my hair again, gently massaging my scalp.
"It helps."
We are sitting on a tile floor against a tile wall in a dark, sour-smelling room. The only light comes from a flickering bulb in the hall outside, leaking into our cell through the door's barred window. We're in jail. A couple of young deviants caught tearing up the town, drinking, smoking, heavy petting at the drive-in.
"Are you okay?"
I manage to croak as I crawl back into my body. She chuckles.
"What's left of me is.
Our hosts were kind enough to stitch up the stump, which I guess means they're not planning to kill me yet.
Hooray!"
Her fingers trace around the burn on the back of my skull.
"What about you?"
I pull myself upright and stare at nothing, waiting for the damage report. My body feels raw, dried out, like all my joints and muscles have been lightly seared. Waves of nausea wash over me, followed by an undertow of feverish heat. And of course, my head. The steady throb of blood pounding against constricted vessels, squeezing against my sinuses, crushing my eyes in their sockets.
"Just a little hungover," I mumble.
She smiles bitterly.
"Wild night."
We are silent for a moment. Will there ever be a funeral? Will there be a day to stop and acknowledge the cutting of Lawrence Rosso's thread? Or will he be swept up with the rest of the day's tragedies and dumped into the wastebasket of the new world, where death is not a headline but a weather report? Julie stands up and paces slowly around the room. In the flickers of light through the door, I see a row of sinks, a row of toilet stalls. Our jail is a restroom. Julie stops in front of the shattered mirror and moves from side to side, examining herself in its facets. A puffy eye here, a split lip there. Blue-brown burns everywhere.
"Looking good, Julie," she mutters. "A very good year for Cabernet."
I notice she has a slight limp. "Your leg?" I say.
"Just sore joints. Electricity hurts, doesn't it?
I always thought shock would be the easiest torture since there's no breaking or cutting or, you know." She holds up her bandaged stump. Permanent maiming.
"But wow, it's still pretty bad."
I can't take my eyes off her hand.
"Come sit with me," I say,
feeling a quaver in my voice. She takes a last look in the mirror. She brushes a lock of hair off her forehead, revealing yet another scabbed cut. She sighs and comes back to my corner in the shadows, slides down the wall and settles against me. I hold her bandaged hand, staring at the missing volume in the bookshelf of her fingers. They have stolen a piece of her. She is not diminished. She is no less herself. But I still feel the loss. She is not her body, but her body is her, so I love her body. And some of it is gone. She watches me studying her, and when she notices the glimmer of moisture in my eyes, she self-consciously pulls her hand away. "Look on the bright side," she says, forcing a smile. "If we ever get married, you won't have to buy a ring." We lose track of time sitting in the dark. No one comes to drag us into another interview. No one slides a tray of food under the door. The speaker above the toilets clicks on and plays nondescript instrumental rock for a while, then switches mid-beat to nondescript instrumental hip-hop, then clicks off. Then clicks on again and plays classical. It might be psychological torture, or it might just be these lunatics' idea of ambiance. I try to ignore it. "Mozart," Julie says in a bitter chuckle, staring at the speaker. "It's supposed to be the pinnacle of art, right? This transcendent human achievement. And we use it for background noise in bathrooms. We literally shit on it." There's a pained tightness in her voice. She spasms occasionally and clenches her right hand. When the music clicks off, she immediately turns her attention to the patch of light on the floor. "How long do you think the solar panels will keep working? Will that bulb out there still be flickering when we're dead and everyone we know is dead?" I look at her uneasily. "Sorry," she says, shaking her head. "I'm trying to distract myself." She stands up and goes to the door. She presses her face against the bars. "Hello? Any other prisoners out there? Anyone else enjoying Axiom's exceptional customer service?" She plants a fierce kick against the door. It leaves a dirty boot print but barely vibrates the heavy hinges. "Hey!" she shouts, desperation creeping through her sarcasm. "Hey!" She kicks it again, then grimaces and bends over, clutching her hand.
"God," she says in a raw whisper, "this really hurts."
A small voice echoes from across the hall.
"Julie?"
Her eyes widen and she leaps back to the window.
"Nora? Hey, you."
A surge of disoriented emotion racks Julie's face. A joyful laugh bubbles out of her even as tears fill her eyes.
"I'm so glad you're here."
"You're glad I'm in prison?
Thanks a lot. Julie laughs louder. So I'm a selfish bitch. Yes, I'm glad.
Standing behind Julie, I can see the window of another cell a few feet down the hall. A single frizzy curl pokes out through the bars.
Is R with you? Nora asks.
Yeah, he's in here.
What is this? What do they want?
I don't even know. They think we can control the dead. They're insane.
Are you okay?
Mostly, yeah.
Although this happened.
She sticks her bandaged hand through the bars.
Oh, Jules.
Yeah, we're stump sisters now.
I'm sorry.
Thanks.
You'll get used to it.
The only time it really trips me up is when I'm playing guitar. I was never going to be a musician anyway. That gene died with Dad.
She's quiet for a moment. What about you, though? You're okay?
They haven't fucked with me much. I'm in for disorderly conduct.
What happened?
They were trying to take my Nearlys. I shot a guy.
That's my girl.
A pause.
Jules?
Yeah. Another pause. This one longer.
I heard about Lawrence.
Silence.
I'm so sorry.
Julie leans against the door, pressing her forehead into the bars.
Yeah.
Ella came into the morgue, said she wanted to help someone. I asked if she had any medical training. She said she took a CPR class 20 years ago.
She was okay?
I wouldn't say that. Julie closes her eyes and goes quiet. I push my face to the window.
Nora, have you seen M?
Marcus? The great outdoorsman?
Sure haven't.
But now would be a pretty great time for him to come back, if he's going to.
He's going to, I mumble, half to myself.
He said, see you later.
That's sweet. But what he said to me was, I don't deserve to be here.
I let myself sag back from the window. Julie takes my place.
How long have we been in these fucking bathrooms?
What, you're not carving check marks on the wall of your cell? Where's your prison spirit?
We've been unconscious most of the time.
Oh. Well, I'm pretty sure the explosion was 3 days ago.
Julie nods and looks at the floor, lost in thought.
So today's July 26th?
If I've been counting meals right, yeah,
Nora says.
Why?
To my surprise, Julie laughs. She laughs the way you laugh at a joke you know you shouldn't find funny.
It's my birthday.
There's a pause. Then Nora bursts into a bitter cackle.
Well, happy birthday, Stump Sister. Wishes and kisses.
Why didn't you get me a present, R? What kind of boyfriend are you?
Just think. You're almost old enough to buy beer.
I listen to the two women collapse into fits, exchanging birthday cliches and savoring the fresh irony that coats each one, but I can't make myself join in. Even the blackest edges of my humor are numbed by this. It's an arbitrary line, of course, subjective and ultimately meaningless, but this is not how I imagined Julie's graduating from her teens. In every meaningful way, she's been an adult for many years, certainly longer than I have, but some old-fashioned part of me still wanted to celebrate this official step into maturity. I wanted to get up early and put daisies on her pillow. I wanted to play her favorite records all day. Maybe I'd try to bake a birthday cake. But instead, this is the party I threw for her. Sitting in a jail cell waiting for our next round of torture.
Surprise!
I listen to the two friends riff off each other, and then I wonder if their laughter might have triggered some kind of anti-joy alarm. Because as if on cue, a door bangs open and heavy boots pound down the hall. The laughter stops. Julie backs away from the door until she bumps into me, and I wrap my arms around her, absorbing the icy tremble that's shaking her tiny frame.
R,
she whimpers as a shadow falls across the window, and the cold, terrifying reptile in my brain starts sorting through objects in the room, the mirrors, a shard of glass. The door opens, and Perry Kelvin steps through. Julie's knees collapse. She sags against me. I stumble back and fall into a sitting position, holding her under her armpits.
Time to go, Perry says, reaching out to help me up.
Now.
I hear a distant commotion through the walls. Furious shouts, fists pounding a door. Perry's face is indistinct in the shadows, but the thick eyebrows, the brittle voice, and its subtle drawl. I don't know what he is or how he's here, or if I can trust him, but I can imagine no scenario worse than the one I was just contemplating. I grab his hand and stand up, pulling Julie with me. She keeps her eyes locked on his, unable to speak, but her legs firm up under her, and she follows.
Hey!
Nora shouts, and I see her knuckles gripping the window bars.
Let them go, you piece of shit! They can't help you. I'm the nurse of the living dead. They call me Queen Green. If anyone can control them, it's me.
Is she your friend? Perry asks Julie.
Who are you?
Julie whispers, still staring into his eyes.
Who are you?
Yes, I tell him. She's our friend. Perry unlocks Nora's cell. Nora emerges, sees his face, and freezes.
Holy shit, you look...
The distant clang of a hammer striking a door latch.
Introductions later, Perry says. Follow me.
He runs down the hall, but the women are stunned, immobile.
Who is that?
Julie asks me with fear in her voice. Don't know, doesn't matter. I grab her hand. We're getting out of here. She glances at Nora, then at me, then at the ghost waiting for us at the end of the hall. We run. With every door we burst through, I expect to be greeted by daylight. But each time it's another hall, another chamber, another door. The professionally poured concrete of the inner wall gives way to the rushed corner cutting of post-apocalyptic construction. Moldy drywall, rusty sheet metal, and the ever-present plywood. I don't remember any building this large in City Stadium. I begin to suspect we are elsewhere. The lighting in these outer chambers is more reliable, and I catch glimpses of Perry's face as we chase him through this badly built labyrinth. He's not Perry, of course. How could he be Perry? I personally consumed that man's brain and watched my brethren take his body home in several choice cuts. And then he stowed away in the back of my head, filling in for my absent conscience, and we worked together to repair our souls. I cheered him on into whatever's next. Perry Kelvin and I made peace and parted ways. This man is not him. He is older, thicker, his jaw more pronounced, his skin more weathered. I think Julie and Nora see this too, but the resemblance still shocks them into uncharacteristic silence. A door with a glowing window appears. I nearly salivate at the thought of daylight. After 3 days in this chilly hole of pain and darkness, my skin will drink in the sun like sweet tea. The man who is not Perry holds the door for us and we emerge into... not daylight. A pale street lamp lighting a dark corner. Overhead, a suffocating sky of water-stained concrete. Welcome to Goldman Dome. Not Perry says. Keep moving. Unlike City Stadium, this place makes no attempt to mimic the layout of a real city. No miniature high-rises jutting into open space. No open space at all. Goldman's architects appear to have filled every cubic foot of the dome with structures, all merging into one crooked, creaking mass that extends from the ground to the distant curve of the ceiling. The street we're on appears to be the only exterior path, cutting a line through the grotesque honeycomb from one end of the dome to the other. Pedestrians peer down at us from the web of dizzying catwalks that connect the two halves of the hive. But no alarm. No floodlights. No arrest orders barking from a jumbotron. They sent me to bring you in for another interview, Not Perry says as he leads us down the street toward a row of sunken parking spots like the garage of a cheap apartment complex. I took their walkies and locked them in their office. But they'll get out and call it in, and the dome will shut down. We've got maybe 5 minutes. He unlocks one of the pickup trucks, a beat-up old Ford with a gray primer paint job and a well-stocked gun rack. Julie starts to open the passenger door, but Not Perry holds out his hand. No, all of you get in the bed.
Why?
Nora asks. There's some rope back there. Tie your wrists and pretend you're zombies.
God damn it!
Julie suddenly shouts, snapping out of her trance. Who are you? He sees the flinty glint in her eyes and realizes she has reached her limit. She won't be going anywhere until she gets an answer. Abram Kelvin, he says. I'm Perry's brother. Julie stares at him, eyes flicking over his features, scanning. Perry didn't have a... Look, I told you my name. We really don't have time for the rest of this chat right now. Get in the fucking truck. He hops in and slams the door. I climb into the bed, and after a moment the women follow me. We wrap the rope around our wrists in a few loose coils and lie down on the rusty metal like bundles of firewood. I am the only one who's particularly pale, but their abundance of clotted wounds and bruises make up for their lack of pallor. In this dim underworld light, they'll pass. The truck lurches out of the garage, and I watch the dome's upper reaches scroll past me. A guard on one of the lower catwalks looks down, sees the truck's cargo, and spits. His sickly green phlegm splats an inch from my ear. Almost there, Abram calls back to us through the rear window. Shut up and be dead. I turn to face Julie. Our eyes are inches apart as our heads bounce against the truck. I wonder if she remembers what I taught her about zombie mimicry on our first foray into the airport, ages ago when life was simple. Just me and her and a few comical corpses. Don't overdo it, I whisper to her as the truck slows to a halt under a glaring street lamp. Just act unnatural. I hear a door open and footsteps approach the truck. Position and SSN. Large transport pilot, acquisition assistant, guest combatant hospitality host, Abram replies. 07805-1120. Assignment, 3 uncategorized dead to Incinerator 2. I struggle not to react to this. Bundles of firewood, indeed. I know burning the dead is standard practice. I've seen oozing mounds of us doused in oil and turned into bonfires, a procedure the bonies were fond of documenting in order to remind any deviators of their place in the natural order. But for a brief moment, this appeared to be changing. Goldman's people were watching the situation in city with great interest. They were observing our integration with the living, and as Corridor 2 neared completion and the merger neared signature, it seemed a real possibility that the change would spread. Can it be snuffed so easily by a few small minds with big guns? Pretty long haul for just 3 corpses, the guard says. You got room for a dozen in there. Management's Russian disposal for uncategorized. Worried about it spreading. The guard leans over to look at us, a scruffy man in a beanie and blue flannel instead of the beige Axiom jacket. One of Goldman's original guards. Zombies turning peaceful? He says, studying my face. You're worried about that spreading? They're not turning peaceful. They're going into stasis. The plague's evolving deception tactics. We don't know where it's going, so we're playing it safe. By burning them all? Look, if you have problems with your enclave's new guidelines, you can take it up with management, but right now you need to open this gate so I can do my job, all right? The guard squints at me. I snap my teeth and release a soft, understated groan, the voice of a tortured soul trapped in a rotting body. It's a role I've been researching for years, and perhaps I bring a little too much pathos to it, because the guard's face contorts with guilt. You're gonna burn them alive? They're zombies, you idiot. They're not alive. Open the damn gate. The guard shines his light into our faces, one by one. I'm not sure about this. These guys don't even look infected to me. He pulls out his walkie. I'm gonna have to call management. With a melodramatic and entirely unconvincing moan, Nora bolts upright and grabs his head, bangs it into the side of the truck, and takes a bite of his ear. He staggers back, reaching for his gun, but Abram is already out of the truck and pressing his revolver against the man's temple. Drop the gun, drop the walkie, and open the gate. The guard lets the requested items clatter to the pavement, and his lips begin to tremble as he reaches into his booth to punch in the gate code. By the time he's finished and the steel door is moving, his face is wet with tears and snot. Just do it, he whimpers, pressing his forehead into Abram's gun barrel. I don't think I can do it myself, and I don't want to hurt anybody.
Nora and Julie, who've been groaning and gasping like ridiculous B-movie ghouls, finally drop the act and dissolve into laughter.
"Chin up, soldier," Nora says. "You're not catching any diseases from me without buying me a few drinks."
Abram throws the guard's gun and walkie into the truck and hops in. I give the stunned, open-mouthed man a winning smile, and Nora and Julie wave as we pull away into the city streets. We watch Abram Kelvin drive away from the dome, and feelings rush through us. They are complex and contradictory. Joy, sorrow, longing, love. But our feelings always are. They flood the halls of the library like a rich and ancient liquor, infused with the memories of everything. It is rare to look at anything without imbibing this spirit, because everything is remembered by at least one part of us. Every tree has been a perch. Every stream has been a bath. Every stone has cut a paw or broken a window or been used to build a house. Everything on earth has meant something to someone, and there has never been a person whom no one has loved. So while even a stone has a few threads tied to it, a person has 1,000 ropes, and the man in the truck is pulling us. A part of us begins to separate. A book slides out from our shelves. It's a thin book, coverless and bound with red yarn, and it has been badly damaged. Tears blur its ink. Blood blots its words. But the books in our library can heal. They can grow. They can complete themselves. A part of us emerges from our vastness. A part of us watches Abram and reads him, hoping to learn who he is, hoping to recover a few of the pages that a heartless world ripped out. We follow the truck. Inside the protective sheath of Corridor 2, I can almost pretend I'm in the old world. Smooth black asphalt with freshly painted yellow lines, entirely clear of abandoned cars and the wreckage of collapsed buildings. No bomb craters, no cracks, not so much as a pothole. And the 10-foot concrete walls effectively hide the mess outside, ensuring that nothing shatters this lovely illusion of municipal vitality. They also ensure, incidentally, that we won't be swarmed and eaten by any of my less enlightened former friends. Then the illusion evaporates. The walls dissolve into wooden pore forms and sprouts of rebar, and we're on a standard street again, exposed to the city and all its lurking threats. Despite the countless benefits of a safe route between enclaves, I have no doubt one of Axiom's first acts was to shut down the corridor project, keeping its territory divided into manageable factions. When has a despot ever benefited from bringing people together? The dark clouds begin to release their payload, and Julie and Nora hunch their shoulders as cold rain douses our little tailgate party. I see a few lone zombies staring up at the sky, letting the drops spatter against their unblinking eyes. The dead have always commuted to the city. They slog in every morning from their various hives in the outskirts. They do their gruesome work, then they slog back home to hibernate a few hours before doing it all again. Only recently have some begun to alter this weary ritual. The young gray woman in a tank top and skirt. Is she simply lost? Separated from her hunting party? Or is she feeling the cold of the rain for the first time and wondering why? The blood-smeared man trudging toward the stadium. Is he going there to kill and eat, or to beg for help with these strange new stirrings? As we drive past, both of them whirl toward us and hiss, silvery eyes wide with animal hunger. I tell myself to be patient. Whatever is going to happen won't happen overnight. "See how far you've come, R?" Julie says. "I know you doubt it sometimes, but look at them and look at you. No one would ever guess what you used to be." As always, she is too generous. But I accept the encouragement. Given that I seem to have fooled our rescuer, there may even be some truth to it. Nora slides the rear window open. "Pull over. We're coming inside." "I don't like our distance yet," Abram says without taking his eyes off the road. "Hold on a couple more miles." "Hey, we're in the dead part of town. I feel like shark chum back here. Pull over.
He drives a couple more blocks, then pulls into a parking garage entrance. I see him listening carefully as we climb out of the truck, and I wonder what he's more afraid to hear, the hungry groans of my people or the propeller drones of his. Julie hops into the passenger seat without pausing to consider legroom issues.
So, she says, peering intently at Abram as Nora and I fold our long limbs into the barely there back seat.
Are you ready for that chat?
Abram lets out a slow breath.
Everybody buckled in?
Nora's knees are pressed into her chest. Mine are against my chin.
We're certainly not going anywhere if we crash, Nora says.
Abram pulls out of the garage and heads south toward the freeway, weaving steadily through the rough terrain of vehicular debris. The rain pelts the windshield in fat, splattering drops.
Perry didn't have a brother, Julie says.
He wouldn't remember me much. He was only 5 when he saw me last, and our mother never liked to talk about people we'd lost. Said we should stay in the present.
He smirks. Very convenient philosophy when you misplace a son.
Julie hesitates.
What happened?
The usual. Monsters attack, people die, families get separated. I wandered around on my own for a while, tried to find them. Then Axiom picked me up. The old Axiom, back when they were just your standard corporate militia trying to carve out a market.
I lean forward.
What are they now?
He looks annoyed by the question.
Something different.
Are they human?
He shoots me a glance that says I've secured my status as an idiot.
What the fuck else would they be?
Julie tries to steer us back on course.
So you grew up with them, in their custody?
He hesitates, then chuckles and turns back to the road.
I guess you could call it that.
Feral child raised by wolves.
So why'd you turn on them?
Nora says, folding her arms.
Why are you helping us?
Ahead, one of the city's many stacks of flattened cars has tipped over, blocking the road. Abram engages the four-wheel drive and guides the truck over a pile of two-dimensional coupes, crushed like beer cans for a recycling day that will never come.
The short answer is I thought I'd found my family.
The wipers clear the windshield, and then the rain covers it. The world flashes from soft blur to hideous clarity, and back again. I'd picked up some clues over the years that pointed toward Cascadia, so when I heard we were moving on post, I requested the assignment. I knew it was a long shot, even with free access to hundreds of prisoners. Sorry, I mean guests. And after a few days, I was about to let it drop. But then this guy, he jabs a thumb toward me, this guy says his name, looks right at me and says Perry. The truck falls into grim silence.
Don't worry. He adds, I know he's dead.
How?
Julie says in a small voice.
Would my face have sent you into shock if he was alive? The message was pretty clear.
More silence. I brace myself for him to ask the terrible question, how did he die? But for the moment he spares me.
I assume my parents are dead too,
he says, staring through the windshield.
Julie nods.
Abram's lips are a thin line.
So it's down to me.
We have ascended the hill up to the freeway, and City Stadium is now visible on the horizon behind us. I watch it recede in the rear window, fading into a gray mirage behind sheets of rain.
What's the long answer? Nora says.
Abram doesn't reply.
You betrayed Axiom and fucked up your life just to talk to someone who might know your brother?
I watch his eyes in the mirror. They are familiar, narrow set and brown, like Perry's. But a few extra years have hardened them by centuries.
No,
he says, and takes a small, unmarked exit down into a wooded valley. The street is buried in a thick layer of rotting leaves. The headlights slide across decrepit houses with boarded windows and gutted cars sinking into the rising grass. The kind of homes that probably looked like this even before the apocalypse.
Where are we going? Julie asks.
That's enough questions for a while, Abram says.
At the end of the street, past a dead-end sign riddled with bullet holes, there are signs of life. Men in beige jackets move through the dark in the pale glow of headlamps on low settings.
Are those?
I said, shut up. Hey, I interject, leaning forward, but the gesture feels perfunctory. Julie looks at the side of Abram's face with a kind of injured dismay. No, this is not the boy she once loved. Not even an echo of him. As we approach the camp's entrance, a man emerges from a small tent and lights a cigarette, takes a drag, and waits while Abram rolls down his window. 07805-1120, Abram says in the bored tone of a well-worn procedure. The guard checks a list on a notepad, nods, then shines his headlamp into the back seat.
Who are they?
New hires from Goldman. No numbers yet. He waves us through with his cigarette, leaving a spiral of smoke in the air, and we drive into the camp. Our high beams pierce deep into the shadows, revealing what the camp's conspicuous lack of lighting kept hidden. The property must have been some big family's country commune. 6 houses on one lot, with a barn and a few cabins in the field out back. Mom and Dad and the kids, and maybe even their kids' kids, all holed up at the end of this street, deep in the woods, where no one could disturb their private party with news of the world and its wicked ways. How surprised they must have been to learn that the pot continued to boil even after they left the kitchen. How shocked to see that scalding tide reaching all the way to their door. Now the farm is occupied by a new family with a more active approach to society's imperfections. All the houses and cabins appear to be barracks. Axiom soldiers pop in and out of them on various errands, delivering or receiving weapons and equipment. Beyond the houses, dozens of tents spread across a muddy field like a music festival campground, a miserable Woodstock of war.
What are we doing here?
Nora whispers, despite Abram's instructions.
Won't they be looking for us?
The jamming's heavy around here. Walkies get barely half-mile range. The camp won't know what happened till a messenger arrives.
It was never a negotiation, was it?
Julie says, watching soldiers mount a grenade launcher to the hood of a Toyota pickup.
You'd take a willing merger if you could get it, but you were coming in one way or another.
A bitter smirk touches Abram's mouth. We offer innovative solutions to modern problems. He parks the truck next to one of the cabins. He hops out and goes inside, and we follow him. It's warm and dry in the cabin, and surprisingly cozy with a fire crackling and a little iron stove. There's a twin bed and 2 chairs, a TV, and an old video game system. Perhaps a room for one of the family's adolescent boys seeking independence and manhood. The old bloodstains on the curtains suggest an abrupt end to his quest. His room is now occupied by a woman and a girl. Both of them sit in front of the TV, watching an airplane take off, watching a cat play with an injured bird, watching long-dead singers perform for long-dead celebrity judges. The kaleidoscope of images splashes strange colors on the walls of the room.
About time, the woman says without looking up.
The girl runs to Abram and hugs his leg, but she doesn't smile. She's about 6 years old, straight black hair, tawny skin. The blonde, ruddy-faced woman is clearly not her mother. One of the girl's eyes is big and dark. The other is covered by a sky-blue eye patch with a daisy painted on it.
Hey, little weed, Abram says and hefts her into the crook of his arm. You been having fun with Carol while I was gone?
The girl shakes her head sadly.
Well, of course you haven't. Carol's no fun.
She asks when you're coming back about every 5 minutes, Carol says. I was about to tell her you died, you fucking deadbeat.
It's been a busy week.
So I hear. You owe me 5 days with Luke. Abram bounces the girl on his arm, smiling absently. I might be on assignment for a while, but when I get the days, yeah. He puts her down. Sprout, I need you to get your backpack and pack up your clothes. We're going on a trip.
Carol frowns.
A trip? The fuck you talking about? Abram ignores her and begins throwing clothes and food into a backpack.
Hey, Kelvin, you can't take your kid on assignment.
Thanks for watching, Sprout, Carol. You can head home now if you want.
The light on the walls turns red, and the TV's audio cuts to a warbling alert tone. Abram freezes over his pack.
Oh, shit,
Carol says, rushing up to the screen like her favorite show is about to start. Did they finally get in? Are we live on Fed TV? The tone plays over a blank red screen for about 2 seconds, then the kaleidoscope continues. A bear swiping a salmon out of a stream. A lion pouncing on a zebra in lazy slow motion. Soldiers marching into a village.
This fucking code, Carol mutters. Can you follow it, Kelvin? I haven't finished my homework.
Nope, Abram says with a casual calm that belies the haste of his packing. Check the producer's guide. Carol pulls a thick binder off a shelf and thumps it down on the table as the TV flashes through its collection of tropes.
I can't believe we're gonna keep using the old gov bullshit for all our messaging, she says, flipping through the binder's tabbed and laminated pages. Why can't we just say it straight?
Abram chuckles in spite of himself. If we said it straight, people might actually understand us. Can't have that. Carol glances back at him.
Huh?
It's right there in the title. He jabs a thumb toward the binder, which looks like a manual for some vintage industrial machinery. Leveraging euphemism for the prevention of overcomprehension. Carol examines the binder's cover.
I'll say it again. Huh?
He zips up his pack. Forget it. I'm sure this is just a test run anyway. He moves toward the door. A voice cuts through the background music, methodical and grim.
Everything happens for a reason. Everything has its place.
On the TV, a gorilla paces in a zoo enclosure.
Man is the only creature who questions his.
The gorilla fades into a badly lit photo of a man's face. Abram's face. Carol's eyes widen and she looks at Abram.
Well, that one was clear and...
Abram cracks a fist into her temple. She sinks to the floor.
What the fuck?
Nora shouts. Abram snatches a gun out of Carol's belt and tosses it to Nora. You know how to use that, right? Nora opens her mouth to reply. Then a shot of a goldfish swimming in a tiny tank fades to a photo of Nora sitting on the floor of her cell, scowling at the camera. And she goes quiet.
What the hell is this?
Julie whispers as a goldfinch in a cage fades to a dim shot of her strapped into a torture chair.
Suffering comes when man climbs out of his place, when he resists his nature and rejects his role.
Sprout is staring at her unconscious nanny and whimpering. Abram hefts his pack over his shoulder and grabs his daughter's hand. Move, he says to everyone in the room, and then he's gone. We hesitate, trying to catch up with this turn of events, but a groan from Carol breaks the shock and we move. Before I close the cabin's door, I glance back at the TV and see my own face looking back at me. I don't remember this photo being taken, but my memory is porous even when I haven't been shocked in and out of consciousness. Despite the harsh light of the flash, I look convincingly alive. My skin is pale, but lacks the purple tint of the nearly living. My eyes are thoroughly normal. Brown like mud. Like shit. Like 96% of the world's population last time such things were tallied. This is what I wanted, isn't it? To be just another man living out his lifespan in a world where children suffer and women are beaten and wild animals sit at all the desks.
When nails escape their holes, the TV says, the house falls apart. Find them and bring them back.
A single frame of the Axiom logo flickers over my face. The screen glares red, and that grating alert tone rings out in the empty shed. Then regular programming resumes. Happy kids on tire swings. The green glass of Freedom Tower shining over a young New York. A writhing worm. I fidget in the front seat as we flee the camp at a painfully relaxed idle. It's like trying to play dead while a bear gnaws at my skull. I notice a few soldiers emerging from their tents and shining flashlights into each other's faces, but by the time the search gains any momentum, we're already to the exit.
I see the glow of a television flickering inside the guard's tent, and I tense. Then I see the guard himself still standing outside, halfway through a cigarette. He nods to Abram and waves us through.
Thank God for bad habits, Julie mumbles,
watching his cloud of smoke recede in the rear window. Once we're out of view of the camp, Abram hits the gas. The old engine rattles and backfires, and the truck roars forward, spitting clumps of dead leaves behind us. Instead of going back up the hill to the freeway, he takes a road that runs alongside it, hidden from aerial eyes by a thick ceiling of trees. Where are we going? Julie says, leaning into the front seat. I'll figure that out later, Abram says. Right now we just need some distance. Julie nods. Stay on this road. It's the only one out here that's cleared. Good cover for about 5 miles, and then we can jump on the freeway.
Abram, Nora says to the back of his head, that stuff on the TV, was that really the Lotus feed?
It was the feed we all know and love. It just has new producers.
So our pictures, that arrest warrant or whatever it was.
Abram nods. It just went nationwide. You're officially outlaws. The rough pavement fills the truck with a steady rushing noise like the cabin of an airliner. Abram's daughter looks very frightened, wedged between Julie and Nora, and I wonder how much of this she understands.
How did they do it?
Julie says after a minute of grim silence.
Do what?
Fed TV? Fed FM? People have been trying to get a hold of the feed ever since Babel went online, what, 19 years ago?
20.
So after 20 years of people in America trying to hack this broadcast, you people show up.
Her voice trembles and begins to rise.
Smash into our homes, take control of our city, and while you're at it, you go ahead and grab the Holy Grail? The only unjammed frequency in the whole country?
She shakes her head.
How?
I remember that brief interruption I observed on the bar's TV. Security footage of the pitchman's assistants in some strange, dark chamber. A slow knock on the door in my head. Tap, tap, tap.
It's in the stadium, I blurt.
All eyes fall on me except Abram's. The source of the feed is in the stadium. I see a trace of a bitter smile on Abram's face, and I look right at him.
It's what you really came for.
He shrugs.
Well, we didn't come for the nightlife.
Bullshit,
Julie says, squinting at him like this is some inscrutable joke.
People have been living in city for over a decade. We've turned the place inside out. You're saying we were sitting on the Lotus broadcast station that whole time and no one knew about it?
Someone knew about it. Julie's indignation freezes. Her demeanor shifts.
What do you mean?
She says in a low voice. Abram sighs. Look, I'm not executive. I'm not even management. I just fly cargo and watch prisoners. So it's not like I'm invited to the smoky room where the plots are hatched. But from what I've heard, about 2 months ago someone spliced a new message into the feed.
Julie stares at him.
It was crude, obviously rushed, but whoever sent it knew the code, and so did we.
What did it say?
She asks quietly.
That your stadium was under attack and we should come here and protect it, because you had what we wanted.
Julie closes her eyes. She takes the realization like a martyr taking a bullet, barely flinching. And I suppose after watching her father try to kill her and then surrender himself to be eaten, this desperate final act may come as no surprise. But the betrayal that preceded it, the years of knowing what they had and choosing not to share it, that part cuts through. I can see it digging deeper the longer she contemplates it. Nora notices this and tries to change the subject.
By the way, Abram Kelvin, she taps his headrest, since you seem so eager to get to know us, my name's Nora.
Abram smiles dryly.
Right, names. We don't use them much where I'm from.
He glances at Julie, but she's looking out the window, traveling dark paths in her mind, so Nora fills in for her.
That's Julie. She and your brother were a thing.
Abram's smile fades into a distant blankness. He seems oddly uninterested in pursuing that topic, so I take my turn in the introductions. I'm R. Art? R. Just the letter. He glances me up and down as if having an unusual name suggests physical defects. Who has a letter for a name? I shrug. I do. He holds my gaze for a moment in some kind of trust-testing ritual, then grunts and returns his eyes to the road. Who names their kid Sprout? Nora says, and we all jump a little when Sprout herself answers. I do. It's the first time we've heard her voice. We named her Murasaki, Abram sighs. Then one day I said she was growing like a bean sprout, and for some reason she latched onto it. Sprout's face flickers into a grin, showing both rows of teeth and a few gaps, then lapses back into worry. Where's her mom? I ask, and Julie emerges from her brooding to shoot me a stern glance. I recall a lesson she taught me early in my rehumanization. If a family member is conspicuously absent, never ask where they are. You know damn well where they are. To my relief, Abram ignores me. Thank you, by the way, Julie says to him, still subdued but recovering. Never got a chance to say that. Abram looks back at her. Thank you. For what? For getting us out of Goldman. Considering this was happening by our third day, she flashes her bandaged stump. I'm guessing we wouldn't have lasted much longer. He turns back to the road, shaking his head, but Julie continues. I know you said you had other reasons for ditching Axiom, but you still took a big risk to break us out. If you'd just left quietly, you might not be a fugitive right now, so... thanks. I didn't do it for you, he says with a note of disgust. Why would I risk my life for some strangers in a jail cell? You had information about my family. Management was about to kill you. It was a good time to make my move. Julie lowers her brows. Hey, asshole. I'm not saying you're a hero. I'm just saying thanks. Abram chuckles darkly. I throw you in jail, watch you get tortured, then drag you out into the wilderness to probably get killed by my employers, and you say thanks. He shakes his head again. I shouldn't have interfered with natural selection. You're clearly not meant to make it. My mind drifts out the window and into the darkness, away from this turbulent chatter. I picture M wandering alone in the forest, gripping his head and groaning as his old self tries to dig a nest in his brain, maybe throwing himself off a waterfall to end the confusion, and a scared, selfish part of me envies him. The simplicity of his struggle. One man fighting one fight, his own. I understand inner conflicts, but to fight for and against other people, to engage with the world outside of me, this is a lot more complicated. I look at Julie in the rearview mirror, hoping to make some kind of meaningful contact, to share a glance that says, what a mess we're in. But she's busy glaring out the window, stunned into silence by our driver's impenetrable shell. I stare for a moment, trying to catch her eyes, and then I notice something in the window behind her head. Two points of light floating in the trees. They blink and flicker, disappear for a moment, then flicker back. Fireflies? Fairies? A memory creeps into my consciousness, not something from the forbidden basement of my first life, but a dusty relic from the beginning of my second. I'm wandering in the woods alone, dragged on a leash by a hungry brute inside me. I'm trying to piece together the nature of reality, what trees are, what animals are, what I am. But reality keeps changing. There are strange things in the woods, hovering hands and shadows that glow and faces peering from holes in the air. These lights in the window seem to belong to that dream. Floating eyes, the Cheshire Cat. Then they accelerate, they draw closer, and the whine of an engine erases all this whimsy. Headlights. I thought we'd have a bigger lead, Abram mutters, and guns the truck to speeds that wouldn't be safe on a major highway, much less this leaf-strewn back road. I hear the click of seatbelts behind me. Our pursuers gain steadily until I can make out the contours of their much newer, much faster vehicle, a nearly mint Porsche SUV.
Why do they have a fucking sports car?
Nora squeals,
You've worked for them all these years, and you're driving this piece of shit?
I need you to shut up now, Abram says through gritted teeth, as he struggles to maintain control of the old Ford. Its creaky suspension fails to soften the constant barrage of potholes, and I feel my jaw rattling. The engine roars like a sick bear. The Porsche pulls up directly behind us and flashes its high beams. A friendly notice from a concerned fellow driver. Hey, buddy, you've got a taillight out. Then it rams us. It's only a warning bump, nudging us into a momentary skid, but at this speed, the sensation is terrifying. Sprout begins to cry in short, panicked bursts, and Julie wraps an arm around her. In the glow of the Porsche's headlights reflecting off our tailgate, I notice a long steel tube mounted to its hood, with two hoses running back into the trunk space. I turn to Abram, who is concentrating fiercely on the road ahead of him. I don't know how to break the news gently, so I just say it. They have a flamethrower. A chuckle bursts out of him. He closes his eyes for a moment, gathering himself, then veers to the right and slams on the brakes. The Porsche rushes past us. He tosses a pistol into my lap, and I stare at it like it's alien technology, an exotic ray gun. I can't.
The hell you mean you can't?
I can't shoot. I reach a shaky hand back to give the gun to Julie, but she's busy trying to calm Sprout and doesn't see it. The Porsche is pulling around. Nora grabs a rifle off the truck's gun rack and climbs out the rear window into the bed. She drops to one knee and takes aim as the nimble Porsche whips a U-turn and comes up behind us again. She gets only one shot off before they ram us, knocking her on her back, but the driver's side of the windshield is suddenly red. The Porsche stops. Abram hits the gas, and the Porsche starts to recede behind us before its driver is replaced and it comes to life again.
Nora, get inside, Julie shouts. Just a minute,
Nora says, taking aim.
I'm really good at this.
She fires. One of the Porsche's front tires hisses and starts to flap, then seals and reinflates itself.
This is so unfair,
she grumbles.
Nora, get in! They're going to—
Another collision knocks the words out of Julie's mouth and sends Nora toppling against the tailgate. As she climbs to her knees, she finds herself staring into the barrel of the flamethrower, its pilot light guttering in the wind like a tiki torch. She scampers to the window and wriggles inside, and Julie slides it shut just as the rear of the truck erupts into an orange blaze. Such things have a way of ending an exciting car chase. As the window seals melt, as the women scream and press themselves against the front seats to escape the hair-curling heat, I see an ancient service station ahead, a place for weary travelers to grab some beef jerky and top off their tanks before continuing on into the wilderness. Both rear tires burst. The truck careens out of control, and as I see the gas pump's barrier post rushing toward us, I have just enough time to think, good thing I buckled up. Before we hit the post, and my seatbelt rips free of the truck's rusted chassis, and I hurtle headfirst through the windshield. I am flying. I'm flying in a plane. I'm flying in an armored plane, and there are old men in all the seats, and one of them is grinning at me from across the table and explaining something about necessity and something about ends and means and justification, because he thinks I still require justification, that I still want to believe I'm good. He thinks no one so young could grasp the truth of the world so quickly, but he is wrong. I sip my whiskey and listen to him drone. The old men are gone, and I am on a smaller plane, and this one is crashing. An ocean of evergreens spreads out below us, and a blonde woman gives me one last look, perhaps a goodbye. Julie screams my name. The trees tear into the plane. The gravel tears into my shoulder, and I roll over and over until my body slaps against a dumpster. I immediately rise to my feet, ready to fight enemies and protect friends, but then I remember. I feel pain now. I am soft and sensitive. I am human. And I have just flown through a windshield. Blood trickles into my eyes and my head is beginning to howl. I feel every inch of my injuries, but I fight my way through them. I stagger toward the burning truck. Abram crawls out and opens the rear door on Julie's side.
I feel a twinge of unpleasant emotion as he reaches in to rescue the woman I love, while I stumble toward her, a dizzy, useless mess. But he reaches past Julie and lifts his daughter out. He sets Sprout in the grass a safe distance away, and by the time he looks back at the truck, I'm there. Julie and Nora look unharmed, but dazed by their impact with the front seats. The rear window is a stovetop, and the air reeks of burnt hair. I pull Julie out, and Nora scoots out after her. And as we run toward the service station to hide from the imminent explosion, a man in a beige jacket steps out of the darkness with a fire extinguisher. The reproachful glare he gives us as he smothers the truck in white foam says we should be ashamed for causing all this trouble. Julie, Nora, and Abram pat themselves down like they're checking for keys and wallets before leaving the house. But the guns are in the truck. Two more Axiom soldiers emerge from the smoke, rifles drawn. The first one drops the extinguisher and joins his comrades, and I notice a gray tie underneath his coat, incongruous with the rugged utility of his uniform. The tie is rank. The color is function. Together they show, "Shut up," I snap, throttling my thoughts into submission. "You don't know these things." Gray tie draws his pistol but doesn't bother raising it. We are already thoroughly covered.
"Well?"
he says impatiently.
"Hands up?"
We raise our hands. I feel the wetness behind my head. My blood is not yet hot, but it's at least higher than ambient temperature. Warm blood, cold comfort. "Parker," Abram says, "you're making a mistake." Parker is younger than Abram, mid-twenties, with a slouching stance and a lazy smirk. He looks bored.
"These three," he says, pointing from me to Julie to Abram, "we take them back to the dome."
He points at Nora.
"We can kill this one."
"What?"
Nora blurts.
"No, you can't. The TV said find them and bring them back."
"It showed cages for these three," Parker says. "That means capture. Fish tank for you. That means kill."
"A fish tank is a cage, you idiot. You're supposed to capture all of us."
Parker glances at his comrades.
"I'm pretty sure fish tank means kill. You know, like sleep with the fishes."
"Oh my God, your code sucks,"
Nora groans. Parker shrugs.
"If I'm wrong, I'm doing you a favor. You don't want to go where your friends are going."
"Parker, listen to me," Abram says, taking a step forward. The other soldiers raise their guns, but he ignores them. "Axiom's a runaway train. You need to get out while you can."
"Shut up, Kelvin," Parker says, finally raising his gun. "And step back."
Abram steps forward. "Don't tell me you haven't noticed the change since the hiatus. We're spreading too fast, taking territory we don't need and can't hold. And you never hear a word about an endgame."
"An endgame?" Parker scoffs. "You're a fucking transport pilot, Kelvin. Leave the end game to executive."
"And where is executive? Who's on the board and who put them there? Do you even know who the president is right now?" Parker glances to the side, thinking.
"We get our orders from our bosses and they get theirs from their bosses, but you ask who's at the top and you get blank stares. You ask these fucking pitchmen anything, you get blank stares."
Parker shrugs.
"Okay, yeah, those guys are a little spooky. New training techniques, I hear."
He squints.
"But what's your point?"
"My point is it's not safe here anymore." He takes another step forward, but the desperation in his voice tells me this is no ploy to distract Parker. He means every word. "Who are we working for? What is our product? There's no security in a company where you can't answer that. What if there is no one at the top? What if Axiom's a headless chicken just following leftover impulses, scratching the dirt while it bleeds to death?" Parker stares at him for a moment, then bursts into laughter.
"Wow, Kelvin. I've heard some bullshit come out of your mouth, but that's a fresh pile. Is this how you managed to work here half your life without even making brown tie?"
Parker.
"What a waste. If you could have learned how to shut up and do your job, you would have been upper management by now."
Parker, listen.
Nah, we're done here.
Parker waves his gun toward the Porsche. Go ahead and get in the car before I misinterpret the code again and decide birdcage means kill. Abram grinds his teeth. He doesn't move. Parker lets his gun drift from Abram's head to Sprout's.
You know, your kid wasn't mentioned in the broadcast. Guess it's up to me to decide what happens to her.
Daddy? Sprout whimpers, staring into the pistol's barrel, and Abram's body stiffens as if flooded with electricity.
Get that away from my daughter, he says in a level growl.
Or what, Kelvin?
Or I'll walk through every bullet in the clip and snap your neck while I bleed out.
Parker hesitates, then snorts to mask the concession as he moves the gun away.
Will you just get in the fucking car? This is boring.
Abram grabs Sprout's hand and pulls her close.
You're a fool, Parker.
And yet, I'm the one with the gun and the tie and the guaranteed housing in Manhattan, and you're the one going to jail.
Abram spits on the ground and moves toward the Porsche. Parker waves his gun at me and Julie.
You too, kids.
We take a few halting steps. The other two soldiers go with us, keeping weapons trained on our heads. Parker jabs his pistol into Nora's back and says,
Into the ditch, please.
Just let her go, Julie shouts, her eyes beginning to glisten. They don't even want her. She has nothing to do with this. Just take us and let her go.
You're new, aren't you?
Parker chuckles.
Axiom doesn't let go.
Nora steps down into the ditch, into the congealed muck of the gas station's oily runoff. Parker goes around behind her, perhaps to keep his eyes on us, perhaps to ensure that we get an unobstructed view. Julie stares at Nora, speechless, helpless. Nora's face is stone, but she gives Julie a small nod, as if to absolve her of responsibility for what's about to happen. And is this really about to happen? Did the path of Nora Green's life weave through so many dangers and heartbreaks and long, lonely miles just to terminate in this ditch because a man she's never met saw a fish on television? My mind refuses to accept it, even as Parker raises the pistol to her head. Even as Julie lunges toward her, screaming, and the soldiers slam her back against the car, even as my vision begins to blur. But as Parker braces for a spray of blood, a figure emerges from the shadows behind him. A big arm wraps around his neck, and a big hand clamps down on his gun. He has 2 sweet seconds to comprehend his change in fortune before his comrades open fire and the arm jerks him around to face them, and he becomes a soft, fleshy shield for the man operating him like a puppet. While Parker's men fill his chest with bullets, his own gun does the same to their heads, until the arm around his neck finally uncoils and all 3 soldiers slump to the ground. The big arm belongs to a big man, tall and bulky, bearded and bald. His white t-shirt is stained with mud and sweat and tree sap, and now with a great deal of blood.
Been remembering a lot, M says, shaking the gun free from Parker's lifeless grip. Used to be a wrestler. A marine, a mercenary. Lots of rough stuff.
He surveys the bodies around him with a look of mild amazement.
Funny. Always figured I was a poet or something.
A rare phenomenon occurs inside of me. A bubble of warmth appears in my chest. My larynx spasms. I laugh. M turns to Nora.
You okay?
She nods. Too shocked to speak.
Plug your ears.
M debrains the twitching body at his feet, fulfilling his responsibility to society, then climbs out of the ditch with a smile on his scarred lips.
Hey, Archie.
I run forward and hug him. His giant palm thumps my back, knocking some breath out of me.
Good to see you, M.
It's Marcus.
Was afraid you were going to...
Nah.
It's answer enough for me. I step back, grinning.
Where the hell did you come from?
Julie says, finally lifting her hands from Sprout's eyes. I thought you were up in the woods.
Tried it for a while, he shrugs. Nature's boring.
A faint smile creeps through Nora's shock.
Came down to the gas station to find beer.
Found some. He rubs his forehead with a grimace.
Was trying to sleep it off, and you noisy motherfuckers.
He spreads his palms wide, taking in the blood-sprayed Porsche, the wrecked, smoldering truck, and the three dead men in beige jackets.
What the hell?
Marcus, Nora says, touching his shoulder. A lot happened while you were camping.